Good evening. Tonight we are learning Parshat Behar. Here in Israel, this Shabbat we will read Parshat Behar. Can you imagine a reality where a whole country takes off for a year? No one works. Can you imagine such a country? Can you imagine a country where we just open the gates? Everyone can go into everyone's fields. You know, if you thought communism was difficult, so the Torah gives you a system where the Torah says you must have private ownership. A basic concept in Torah is there is private ownership. There's mine, there's yours. I respect your belongings, you respect my belongings. Right after the Torah is given at Sinai, we have Lo Tignov, don't steal. And then we have a delineation in Parshat Mishpatim. What's mine? What are my responsibilities? So there is private ownership. It's a basic concept in Torah. As Rav Hirsch points out, when the Mishnah says in Pirkei Avot, Sheli Shelcha, what's mine is made available to you as though it's yours. The Mishnah began by first defining it as mine. If you know that it's mine, and only after you agree that it's mine, then I make it available to you, then you could have a society. However, if everything is everyone's, then you don't have a society. And that's why Rav Hirsch writes and Rav Henkin writes that communism couldn't work. However, the Torah tells us that when the seventh year comes, you don't relinquish ownership over your belongings. You don't relinquish ownership over your home, but you do something else. You open up your fields. You allow other people access to what's growing in your field, and you do not plant. So Shemitah was not so many years ago. 3.5 years ago it was Shemitah here in Israel. And you don't plant. Now imagine a society that lives off of agriculture. So the Torah promises us, on the sixth year, there will be so much produce, it will last you through the seventh year. You won't even have to import. It will last you until the eighth year, because you don't plant on the seventh. So you'll plant on the eighth. You have to wait until the ninth, till you've harvested it and you can eat it. So your produce of the sixth year will last you 2 years. Torah's promise. So now, that's the first point in the system of Shemitah. Torah says, Shamot, let go. Let go. Shamot means let go. So we have this concept of Shin Mem Vav Tet, Shamot. Shemitah, Shin Mem Yud Tet He. So, on the seventh year, we don't work the land. Yes? When the Jewish people entered the land of Israel, they did not keep Shemitah. They were not successful in keeping this mitzvah. As we read in Haftarah, there were years, sure.
They will let you eat in the
for sure. For sure. For sure. There were farmers who kept this mitzvah. And we have also funds where we support the farmers who keep this mitzvah. For sure. So,
yeah. How about the hydroponics? Those plants that they said, there's nothing that matters.
You want to get myself.
It's more complicated than that. It deserves a longer discussion. Remind me. So we don't plant on Shemitah. We don't harvest. What are we allowed to do? The Gemara says, Ukme ilana, the things that keep the tree from dying. Ukme, to keep it. Avruye, if you're going to make it flourish, that we don't do on Shemitah. But if I don't water it, it's going to die, I'm allowed to water it. Now, when Shemitah comes, the fruit is holy. Torah says, eat the fruit of Shemitah. Eat it, le'ochla. The fruit of Shemitah is there for you to eat. What fruit? Well, the trees give fruit. They grow on their own. You have sifichim. That means if you harvested tomatoes. You know, I used to volunteer in an organization that would package food for the poor. So next to where we worked, there was a yard. And whenever we'd have a rotten tomato, some of the workers would put it in the garbage, and others would throw it into the yard. After a year or two in that yard, you start having tomato bugs growing. Why? Because they threw the rotten tomatoes in his yard. The seeds went into the ground. You start having tomatoes growing there because of the rotten tomatoes they threw in his yard. So as you harvest, sometimes you step on a tomato, sometimes some seeds fall. So whenever you harvest, even without planting, there are those things that will grow on their own. A little bit will grow on its own. That's called sifichim, the things that grow on their own without you planting them. So the Torah says the fruits, they grow on their own. The vegetables where you have sifichim, you're not allowed to treat it as your own. We don't say this is my field. No trespassing. No, we make the field available for everyone. The fruit that we harvest is kadosh, is holy with the holiness of Shemitah, and we have to eat it. We're not allowed to waste it. So that means in the year of Shemitah here in Israel, when we take Shemitah grape juice, or when we take Shemitah bananas, or when we take Shemitah grown apples, we're careful to finish it. We don't just throw out the core with a lot of food on it. When we make Havdalah, so even though other years we let the cup spill over, it's a sign of plenty for the family, for the house, for that week. So on the Shemitah grape juice, if you have Shemitah grape juice, you don't let the cup overflow. How does it work? How do you get Shemitah grape juice? So what happens in Israel nowadays? So we have, historically, we've had a very hard time keeping Shemitah. The rabbis saw that the people weren't keeping Shemitah. So in the period of the first Beit HaMikdash, the Navi Yirmiyahu yells at them, you guys have to keep Shemitah. And they try and it doesn't work. And so we have 70 cycles of Shemitah that we transgress. And so we go into exile for 70 years. Then we come back during this period of the second Beit HaMikdash. And again, the rabbis see that the people aren't good at keeping Shemitah. So what they do is they establish a legal system. The courts come to the farmer and they say, Mr. Give him a Jewish name. What's his name?
Goldstein.
Mr. Goldstein. Okay. Mr. Goldstein. You have 50 acres of an apple orchard. We see you have 50 acres of the apple orchard. You're not allowed to treat that as your own on Shemitah. If you open the gates, what's going to happen? A bunch of people will come. They'll pick all your apples, and no one will enjoy them except for them. So what we are going to do, the Beit Din establishes, the courts bring their workers, and they say, Mr. Goldstein, our workers will pick all the apples and put them in a storage place, and they will ration out the apples. Every family that wants can come and get some free apples. That's called Otsar Beit Din. That the court takes over the field, and then they collect the fruits, and then they give out an rationed amount to every family that wants from the fruits that grow in that field. What happens? The courts say, wait a second, who's going to work for us for free? If we want to take care of your field and harvest your fruit and then transport it, that costs us money. So those who want to take from our rations have to cover our costs. So if, let's say, we have 50 acres of apples, and in order to take care of those 50 acres, it's going to cost us 3 shekel per kilo to take care of your apples. So we don't want to sell it by weight. We will make bags of apples or boxes of apples. Each one has about 3 kilo. Plus, minus, each one has, let's say, 20 apples. We factor every box costs us X amount of money to take care of it. That's what you have to pay to collect our apples. So then, you have a situation where the court is giving it to you for free. But they're saying, you got to cover our cost. We're not charging you for the apple, but we do want you to cover our cost. And this is what the Bet Din instituted already 2,000 years ago. It's quoted in the Tosefta, it's quoted in the Ramban, in Nachmanides, until today. And when the Shemitah year comes, there's Otzar Beis Din. So you can go to the store, and many places, I don't go to a store, I buy it from families. The court of Rav Nissim Karelitz takes over many fields, and here on Cutler Street, the last two Shemitah cycles, meaning 3.5 years ago and 10.5 years ago, there was a family who was representative of that court, and two nights a week, you could come to their house, and you could take a cluster of bananas for 20 shekel. A box of apples for 35 shekel. You didn't weigh it. They didn't weigh it. They said, we know each box costs the court this much. You pay us, that covers the cost of the court. Now, it's almost always much cheaper than the cost of fruits in the regular store, because they're not really making a profit. They're covering their cost. However, this past Shemitah cycle, an organization came out. They were around last Shemitah cycle. This Shemitah cycle, they became very, very big. And they started taking over big supermarket chains, where they bought up tons and tons and tons of produce. And they succeeded in closing a contract with the army. They closed the contract with Rami Levi. The biggest supermarket chains and the army had places which were designated as Otzar Beit Din. You're not paying for the food here. You're paying the court. And they promised us, we met with them, a committee of rabbis met with them before Shemitah. They promised us that they would sell it by bags, no weighing it. They weighed it. They promised us that everyone who would get the Shemitah fruit would get an instruction guide. How to deal with it wholly. No one got instruction guides that I know of. In our neighborhood, we didn't see any such instruction guides. We asked them, you're not supposed to give Shemitah produce to non-Jews. They said, we're selling it in kosher places. They sold it in Rami Levi, where at least 50% or more, at least the Rami Levi in my neighborhood, is non-Jews buying the Shemitah fruit. So they did not live up to our expectations of how an Otzar Beis Din should run. On the other hand, they succeeded in bringing Shemitah produce to the army and to tens and tens of thousands of Jews who could eat the Shemitah food. What's the major advantage of doing this? Number one, you're helping the farmer. Because what really happens, the courts come to the farmer's field and they tell him, look, you know your field better than us. You're not allowed to work your field, but maybe we will hire you. You won't make a profit on your apples, but you will be our worker, and we will pay you for your time when you will take care of your apples the way we instruct you. So then the farmer says, okay, I'm letting go of my field, but I'm working for the courts. I know my field best. I have the machinery. I have everything you need. Hire me. So then the farmer can keep Shemitah because he's not working his own field. It's not his apples, it's the court's apples. He gives it over to them, but he's getting a salary, he can live. So this allows the farmers to keep Shemitah, it allows us, the regular citizens, to get our hands on the Shemitah produce. You're going to go find an apple orchard up in the Golan and go pick apples? You're going to go down to the south and pick bananas? How are you ever going to eat Shemitah fruit from here in your house in Jerusalem? So by arranging the Otzar Beis Din, we facilitate many mitzvot. This Otzar Beis Din that came out in mass had challenges, and there's room to discuss whether the way they dealt with the challenges was the optimal way or not. It's always easy to sit on the outside and criticize. The flip side is they accomplished what no one before them accomplished. The army was eating Shemitah produce. You had tons and tons of produce from farmers who were able to keep Shemitah. So there's a good question that there are many things that we would have liked to see better. However, there were many advantages to what was accomplished, it would seem, by this Otzar Haaretz, this past Shemitah. I don't know enough about how much they really kept to the halacha, meaning there's a major question here. Did they keep Shemitah? Did they only do what they're permitted to do in the fields? Were things really done the way they should? Okay, we'll have to assume that they were. Coming back to here. So this concept of Otzar Beis Din This concept is a concept that dates back already over 2,000 years. There are a few other concepts, which we'll discuss in a minute. Yes?
The promise of the Torah that the land will produce much more than 6 years in 70 days, doesn't it become true?
I don't know. Good question. I don't know. The Torah promises you the sixth year will cover your seventh and eighth year. So why do we need these gimmicks? Didn't they get enough in the sixth year? It's a good question. I don't know the answer. Next. So about 600 years ago, the farmers in Israel had a very big problem. They didn't see how they would last the Shemitah year. And so the rabbinate then came up with the following. It's called today Heter Mechira. They take a non-Jew and they sell him the land before Shemitah, and then he sells the produce of the land to the Jews. So now it's not a Jew who's working the land on Shemitah. Whether this is a good Heter or a bad Heter, it's for sure a problematic Heter. But the Heter dates back 600 years, and the farmers here felt that they would die without it. And so the rabbis here 600 years ago approved it. And then, about 200 years ago, when the Jews came back to the land of Israel, so the chief rabbis again saw a great need, and they instituted what's called the Heter Mechira. When Rav Kook became the chief rabbi, so there was an argument whether it was still necessary or not, and Rav Kook went in line with what all his predecessors had done and kept doing the Heter Mechira. At that point, many rabbis came out against him, and it became very political, and it became the Heter of Rav Kook, the Heter Mechira, which is inaccurate historically. It existed before him in Israel, and it existed even before that, centuries ago in Israel. He didn't invent it. If anything, Rav Kook improved on it. However, the question is it a good Heter? Is it something good to rely on? And quite a few great halachic authorities held that one should prefer not to rely on the Heter Mechira. But as they wrote, that's not to say that you cannot rely on it. There are two types of arguments. There's an argument where I hold my way, you hold your way, and I believe you have nothing to stand on. And so I wouldn't accept what you say at all. And then there's an argument where I hold my way, you hold your way, but I hold that your way is also legitimate. I still hold my way, but I give legitimacy to the other opinion. And that's what many great opinions held, that even though they didn't agree with Rav Kook, they held that what Rav Kook did was legitimate. Then comes the question today, how much does the state of Israel really need the agriculture? How much do we still have to apply this Heter, and is it implemented in a way that is the way Rav Kook approved? Which is again a new point of argument, where some would say, oh, today the reasoning isn't valid. Our economy is not reliant on agriculture. We import anyways. And there are claims about the way it is done today. Some want to argue that the way it is done is less good halachically. But the chief rabbinate still backs it. And there are still many, many farmers that rely on the Heter Mechira. Now we come to part three. What's the third thing that's available here in Israel? That's called Yevul Nochri. Non-Jewish produce. So Aza makes a lot of money by selling us tomatoes. Aza sells tomatoes to Israel. That's Jewish territory. The fact that there are guests right now sitting on Jewish territory is a side point. But Aza is Jewish territory. That's our land. So the Arabs are working our land. Right now there are guests on that territory. Okay, so wait. If an Arab takes hold of a Jew's property, or an Arab has legal ownership of parts of the land of Israel, and they grow tomatoes on that land, are those tomatoes Shemitah food or not? That is a machloket, that is a point of argument. And it was a machloket between Rav Yosef Karo and his contemporary, the Mabit. So here in Jerusalem, the custom that's accepted is we do not treat that food as holy. we treat Yevul Nochri, the produce of non-Jews, as non-holy food, as non-Shemitah produce. Outside Jerusalem, so other places did not go with Rav Yosef Karo's opinion. In Bnei Brak, they are concerned for the opinion of the Mabit. They do treat non-Jewish produce on Shemitah as holy food, as Shemitah food. Till today, when you go to the supermarket and look at Carmel wines, even the Baron Rothschild series of Carmel wines, or you look at certain pickles, you will see that it says on it, Heter Mechira. Now you know what that is. You will see that it says on it, Yevul Nachri, non-Jewish produce from the land of Israel. You will see that some pickles have on their imprint, together with the date, it says Yevul Shishit, produce from the sixth year. You know you're eating pickles that are 4 years old, right? But you'll see that till today, there's produce in the supermarket that reflects Shemitah, with one of these signs. Yes, sir. Good evening, Gabriel. That's a personal question.
I'm curious about this. I don't know if I'm correct, but I think in the Shemitah here, when farmers take a break, they hire other people and then to that.
That's a good question for a Thursday night. There's a lot to be discussed about that.
But am I correct? I think I heard an opinion they do that.
Or, I'd rather answer that in more depth than yes or no. Let's discuss it Thursday night. Bring it up Thursday night, okay? I want you here tonight, and I want you here Thursday night. Look at that. You have a fan in Machon Meir. I'm sure you have more than one, but one you have. Okay. So.
Seems like the Hester Mechiva is then creating the Yevul Nachri. Just selling the.
Very good.
The Hester Mechiva, the son of Yod to non Jew, then you're creating the Yevul Nachri, the non Jewish produce, so if you're now selling the land to.
Right. So wait, there are more problems here. One of the big issues with Heter Mechira is that you're not allowed to sell land in Israel to a non-Jew.
That's right.
Meaning, the question here is, what's called being Zionistic? So, the Haredi rabbis say, this is non-Zionistic. You are not allowed to sell land in Israel to the non-Jew. And the rabbis who go under the flag of Zionistic say, what do you mean? This is what allows the farmers to succeed here. This is the Zionism. The fact that technically you're selling it to a non-Jew, it's a technicality, but practically you're allowing Jewish farmers to continue settling the land of Israel. So that's part of the argument. I don't want to oversimplify to make believe that's the whole argument, but that's also a component.
It's like selling chametz.
Like
you're selling it, but
you're
not selling it.
It's selling it. Okay, so let me ask you a question. When you sell your chametz on Pesach, is it yours or not?
It's not, because I sold it.
Okay, but it's, so are you allowed to sell the land of Israel to a non-Jew? I'm going with your analogy. Let's say it's equal to chametz, but so you sold it for a year. Who said you're allowed to do that?
But you're allowed to.
Let's just clarify a point. Rav Kook didn't like the Heter Mechira either. Rav Kook didn't come along and say, this is great, this is a fantastic Heter, this is the best option, everyone should go with this. Rav Kook came and wrote letters to many rabbis and he said, I know this isn't ideal, we wish we didn't have to do this, but in light of the situation, I don't see that we have a choice. And so even though it involves relying on all kinds of leniencies in halacha, which I would much rather not do, I think under these circumstances we should do it. Rav Kook didn't come along and say, guys, everyone should adopt this. This is the best heter in the world. Meaning that's why Otzar Beis Din is hands down the best option. Because Otzar Beis Din, coming to Gabriel's question, Otzar Beis Din is both helping the Jewish farmer and keeping the Shemitah and not relying on leniencies. So Otzar Beis Din has the benefits of all angles. Some might argue that you won't be able to get the whole population to sign into Otzer Beis Din. So then perhaps you still need the Heter Mechira. But that's a good question. Can you get everyone to sign on to that? Another point, which is not so relevant to our parsha, but it is a point to be aware of, people argue, I don't know if it's true, but one of the arguments for Heter Mechira is that the enemies of the people of Israel benefit greatly from selling the food to Israel in the Shemitah year. Because if the Jewish farmers can't grow tomatoes, then that means that the farmers from all our enemy neighbors, who it could be Syria, it could be Lebanon, it could be all kinds of wonderful neighbors who are not so interested in our well-being, so they benefit because we buy our produce from them. I mean, even as war was being waged and missiles were coming in during the Shemitah year, you still had truckloads of tomatoes being shipped in. There was an embargo. We didn't allow any food in from Gaza. We didn't allow any, but the food for Shemitah came in. That they allowed. So the argument is, you're funding terrorists in Shemitah. Why don't I like that argument? Because as I said to my friends, I said, you know, for years, I worked very hard with my family to always buy produce from Jewish farmers. I did. We went to special stores. We made a special effort to go to the shuk to buy from one specific seller. We wanted to help the Jewish farmers. Fine. If you do that 6 years, I could hear that argument about the seventh year. But if 6 years you buy produce from Gaza, I'll ask you a simple question. What tomatoes did you eat this afternoon? The tomatoes you had in your salad, where did they buy them from? Does anyone know that it didn't come from Gaza? So for 6 years, no one bats an eyelash. They fund Gaza 6 years running. When comes the seventh year, and it's a question that it might be a transgression, so then suddenly we say, in the name of Zionism, it's okay. So that's why I don't like that argument. Meaning the argument that on Shemitah you have to make sure not to fund the people in Gaza, I say, if you are careful 6 years, then talk to me about the seventh. But if 6 years you ignore this, and you have no problem buying produce that funds people in Gaza or in Jordan, etc., so why are you so concerned on the seventh year? What happened? Now, again, my position is, all years people should be careful. Help the Jewish farmers. Help the agriculture in Israel. I'm saying people should do it always. I'm not saying don't do it. I'm saying do it, but do it all 6 years. 7 years. There were years that we didn't have Otzer Beis Din. So my children got tremendous boosts in their folic acid and in their vitamin B and in all the wonderful things that come with legumes. Going back to Gabriel's question, when we couldn't obtain Otzer Beis Din, so those were months where my children did not eat vegetables. We got them canned vegetables, suddenly they ate more corn, they ate more beans, they ate more fruits, they ate more pasta, they ate other things. Kids don't die if for 4 months they don't eat tomatoes and cucumbers and whatever. I would go to a special store and buy them peppers from Holland. I said, I don't want to rely on the Heter Mechira. I don't want to spend money and it should go to people who are using it for missiles against us. So I said, okay, my kids' diet will shift to other things. So maybe that's very good for them. Maybe I don't give them enough beans all year long. So now they ate more lima beans. They ate more other foods. Today we're rich. Today it's a question of, am I going to eat a tomato or I'm going to eat, you know, ketchup so I get the same vitamins. There's tomato paste. There's so many things today. Think about what Shemitah was like 2,000 years ago. Today, what's the big deal?
The canned food is the 60-year produce?
Yeah, fifth, sixth. I mean, canned food lasts...
From outside the country?
Yes, sir. You're not supposed to do business with the Shemitah food. You're not allowed to go and pick apples and then go and sell them. You're not allowed to, no. The Shemitah food is supposed to always be free. Even if you picked apples, you're not allowed to sell them to someone else. That's why the courts set up a system where you're not paying for the apple. You are covering the court's work. You are not paying for the apple. They say the apple is free. We'll make it available to you, but you have to cover our cost. Yeah, but you weren't supposed to do that. That's true, but you're not supposed to do that. If a person were to sell a bag of apples for 10 shekel, then we say the bag of apples retains the holiness of Shemitah, and the 10 shekels now has the holiness of Shemitah as well. You would have to buy with those 10 shekel some bread or some other food item which is not holy, and then that food item gets the holiness of the Shemitah food and has to be eaten with that holiness. In the land of Israel, you can't waste it, etc. Yes, sir.
Regarding the Shemitah, if you have animals and they eat from the field, can you keep the field closed so the animals won't run away, or can you not?
Leave a door that human beings can open. And a sign that says human beings are welcome.
But technically you would be benefiting from the field because your animals are eating from it.
The Torah says, "V'liv him techa." The produce of the field should be available to your animals, and to the wild animals. The only thing is that what's edible to humans, you're not supposed to feed to animals. You wouldn't be able to eat half a tomato and say, Bessie the cow, you could have the rest, come eat it. You're not allowed to give it. It's edible to humans. Don't give it to the cow. Now, yes, good evening. Dairy is not Shemitah. Milk is not. We don't view milk as growing from the ground. Even though the animal eats the grass and then the animal produces the milk, from our end, milk is like meat. It's not holy with the holiness of Shemitah. Milk. Yeah, maybe. Maybe. And then what do you have? Very good. Okay. So the Torah says the food of Shemitah should be available to you, your animal, and the wild animals of the field. And from here we learn halacha. We learn the concept of bi'ur. Bi'ur means eradicate, get rid of. What does that mean? We learn from here that so long as there's fruit available in the field, you're allowed to hold on to food in your house. So let's say, the Torah said, you're allowed to eat from the food, your animal, and the wild animals. So you go out into your field, and you pick grapes, you bring them home, everyone sits down and eats grapes. You're doing this all week long. Towards the end of the week, you see, or after 2 months, you see that the grapes are finishing. The animals are coming to eat grapes too. Remember, you left the field open. You notice that you have at home 10 buckets of grapes that you're picking and eating. And outside in the field, well, the animals have no more grapes left. So the Torah says, once the food finishes out in the field for the animals, you are not allowed to leave food at home. You have to take it out and say, I'm hereby making this food available for everyone, it's hefker. So we have a concept of bi'ur. Once the food gets finished in the field for the animals, you are not allowed to retain it in the home for yourself. There are two opinions as to how this works. We will discuss the more lenient opinion of the Rash, which is how people in Israel customarily do it. The opinion of the Rash is like this. It says in the Jerusalem Talmud, when the time comes for bi'ur, when the time comes that the produce is finished, and we're not talking about your field, we're talking about more your area. Meaning if you live in northern Israel, if you live in the middle of Israel or southern Israel, each area has its time that the fields no longer have food for the animals. It doesn't go by your personal field. There's zman bi'ur, the time when this food is no longer available in the fields for the wild animals. So the Jerusalem Talmud says, what do you do when the time of bi'ur comes? You wait until the end of the day. as the sun is setting and people are leaving the marketplace because it's getting dark, so there are few people left in the marketplace, then you come out into the marketplace with the produce that you had at home. You had a bucket of grapes left at home. You come out to the marketplace and you wait and you see that the market's almost empty. Everyone's on their way out. There are very few people left. You say, Hefker, 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 this is free for all. Whoever wants can take it. You wait a minute, no one took it. Okay, I'll take it. You take it back home. So now you made it Hefker. You took it out of your domain. You don't have to come in the morning when there are 500 people there and say Hefker, and then everyone's going to come and grab a handful. You don't have to do that. You went to a public place. You went to the marketplace. You went while there were still a few people there. You didn't come in the middle of the night when there was no one there. You came at the end of the day. There were a few people there. You said Hefker. So this is the custom here in Israel today. For example, close to Pesach is the time of Biur for grape juice and wine. So I was once on my way to shul one afternoon, and I see a neighbor of mine. He's taken out about 15 cases of grape juice onto the street, and he goes, Hefker, Hefker, Hefker. So I walk over and I say, are you for real? He goes, yeah. He said, you want, you can take. I said, thank you. I took one case. I took another case. I wanted to see. He didn't say anything. He didn't say anything. So when he didn't say anything, I said, okay, now you can have your grape juice back. I said, you fulfilled the mitzvah. Now you really did the mitzvah. Because you were willing, your hefker was real. You allowed other people to take it. It's all yours. Let me help you schlep it back into the house. And I worked with him for the next 10 minutes, carrying his boxes back up to his house with him. That's hefker. He really said, I relinquish ownership. Whoever wants can come and take it. I had another neighbor who was not so nice. He walked over, took a case, and said, thanks, and walked home with it. Okay? It's permissible. You can't argue with him. He took a whole case of grape juice home. Yeah. Well, the guy said it's free for all. He said it's hefker. Technically, he's allowed to do that. So that's the concept of beer. Now comes another question. How long can you hold on to the food? What happens if the food is in your possession and you didn't say hefker? Is it permissible to be eaten? Why is this relevant to us? Because when you go to the store now and they have grape juice and wine that says on it that it is from Shemitah, in our local supermarket, 2 months ago, just before Pesach, they still had cases and cases, over 100 bottles of grape juice or wine, that was from Otzar Beis Din. So it was Holy Shemitah grape juice or wine, I don't remember what it was. And it was being sold in our local supermarket 3 months ago. Now, the question arises, explain to me guys, what just happened here? You're saying it was by the courts. So I'm asking, well, did the courts take it out in the time of beer and say, hefker, hefker, hefker? What happened with that produce? When you go to a store today and they're offering you Otzar Beis Din, things from the court, or Heter Mechira, things that they sold to the non-Jew. So you could argue if they sold it to the non-Jew, it's not holy, then there's no beer, then there's no responsibility of beer. But that's a point to be addressed, both in terms of Otzar Beis Din, where one could argue that when it's in the hands of the court represents all the people, that's just as good as saying Hefker. You could argue many things, but it's a point to ponder, meaning it's one of the questions on how this system works, both the system of Otzar Beis Din and the system of Heter Mechira. On both of them, there's that question. And you should be aware of it because a year ago, which was 2 years after Shemitah, a year ago, you could still go to the shuk and look at their certificate of kashrut. And the chief rabbinate's certificate had an asterisk. And on the bottom, it had a footnote. And the footnote said, some fruits that are sold by this store that has the Rabbanut of Jerusalem's Kashrut, some of the fruit might still be from Shemitah. Ask your local Orthodox rabbi if you're permitted to eat it. Because of the question of Biur, what did they do with it when it finished off in the field? So that's a question. And even though the chief rabbinate will give the store authorization and a document that says what they sell is kosher, they add that asterisk and they say, however, you should just know some of the fruits here might still be from Shemitah even 2 years later. Which fruits? It's usually the citrus fruits. The citrus fruits very often are thrown into a refrigerator and they're sold a year or two after they grow. So you could be buying an orange today that was actually picked from the tree 2 years ago. That makes it a little difficult. I don't know if they're freezing or refrigerating. It's a good question. I don't know. That makes it difficult with regards to Shechiyanu. We don't always know from when the new fruit are.
So, right now in Canada or United States, is there a question?
I don't think you have to be concerned about it. However, someone told me that in Chutz Laaretz, they did get stuff that had the label on it that said it was from Shemitah. I don't remember what it was. This is a question I get every so often. People buy wine or grape juice, and now Shemitah fruit, you're not allowed to take out of Israel to Chutz Laaretz.
Pineapples and grapes from Israel.
Okay, the question is, from what year?
No, Shemitah year.
Oh, from Shemitah year.
Right after.
Okay.
They didn't accept that. It's in the garbage, but so yeah.
Okay. Who?
The vineyards of the wine.
They do both. You have Otzer Bezni, you have Etzer Mechira, you have everything. Yes?
Which one of the four Rosh Hashanah is the one for Shemitah?
Technically, Rosh Hashanah of Tishrei is for Shemitah. Technically. Should we take another 3 minutes to discuss how you practically keep Shemitah in a home? We'll cover one more aspect of it. Okay. So we mentioned the halacha that you're not allowed to destroy Shemitah food. The Shemitah food is holy, you have to eat it. So now, let's take the following scenario. You have a three-year-old. Your three-year-old is a wonderful, normal three-year-old. And what do? They go, Abba, I want the banana. Abba, I want the banana. Abba, I'll eat the banana. I really want the banana. It's okay. Your three-year-old asks you for a banana. You peel a banana. You give him the banana. And what does he do in classical three-year-old style? He takes a bite or two and puts it down. And you say, I thought you wanted the banana. And he goes, I did. And you go, so why didn't you finish the banana? And what does he say? I'm full. Now what? So you're allergic to bananas. You can't eat that banana. You'll break out in hives. Wait a second. So now if you're a normal Baal Tshuva, what do? You go berserk because it's holy and you're not supposed to destroy it. And that's how people destroy their children's education, because they get all uptight and they make mitzvos instead of being fun and sweet. They make them pressured and annoying. So don't get all annoyed. You shouldn't get all annoyed. He's being a normal three-year-old. He's fine. We have to be calm. We have to take things with a smile. But what are you supposed to do with that banana now? So if you could save it and maybe he'll eat it later, good. And if you don't think he'll eat it later, and if you see that he's not eating it later, what do you do now? So if you were to put it in the regular garbage bin, so then next time you pour your rotten tomato juice or your spoiled milk or whatever you put in the garbage, you will actually be destroying the Shemitah produce, and you're not allowed to destroy Shemitah produce. So what we do instead, let's take another example. You're cutting a tomato, and your wife is one of those wonderful people who don't like eating the stem and where the stem attaches to the tomato. you're calm, you like it, you say it's edible, it's fine, but she, it's anathema to her. And you're cutting her the salad. So you cut out the place where the stem attaches. The only problem is that a lot of fruit comes off with that. You finished eating an apple. Your child finished eating an apple. And there's still food around the core. That is edible, holy Shemitah food. What do you do with that? So you don't put it in the regular garbage bin, because if you'll put it in and then other things will spill on it, you'll be destroying Shemitah food. So what you do is one of two things. Some people, outside their window, they put a little bag and they put in the food in there. And then that food rots after a day or two, then they throw it out. That way it doesn't get filthy in your regular garbage. That's one way of doing it. Another way of doing it is you just put it in a bag. Today we have a lot of bags, right? You just wrap it up and put it in the garbage. And then it'll rot on its own. And whenever you'll pour rotten things into your garbage, you won't be destroying the Shemitah food because it's wrapped up in the garbage. So you can do one of two things. Many homes, my kids come home in the beginning of the Shemitah year, they come home, they build something called the Pach Shemitah, the Shemitah waste basket. What's the idea? The idea is that whatever food you didn't finish, you put in there, and then you close it outside the window, and after a day or two it rots, and you spill it into your regular garbage. But you didn't cause it to rot. It happened on its own. Why do we leave it out the window? Because if you leave it inside the house, you'll have a lot of fruit flies, and they'll end up going into your food and making your food non-kosher. Fruit flies are not kosher. Don't eat them, okay? So you leave them out the window, so the fruit flies bug it outside, not inside your house. That's the idea of leaving it out the window. Technically, you could leave it indoors. It's just not a good idea. Okay, there were questions. Yes?
Can you just throw it on the ground?
No.
Field, so it will, like...
If you wanted to, you could, so long as you don't step on it. Most people don't have. If you put it in your own yard, you'll end up stepping on it.
If I make a hole and put it there, so it will, like...
That's a bit of a problem. You should wait till it rots till you do it, because so long as it's still edible, even though you don't want to eat it, you shouldn't bury it. You shouldn't put it in the ground. What you could do is leave it in a bag. After 2 days, it's non-edible. Then you bury it with the compost.
How do you know? Okay, it's our Tuesday. Most things are the
I didn't hear you.
Makolets
around here have labels. They're usually clearly labeled.
Okay.
Whatever Zotzer Bezdin or whatever is Heter Mechir.
Okay.
If you're buying at a makolet that has a Hechsher, so the Hechsher usually demands of them clear labels. I don't have my phone here, but on my phone I took pictures 3 years ago during Shemitah of a makolet to send my nieces and nephews in Chutzaretz, and I showed them the pepper said Shemitah, the apples, you know, each one had a sign on it from what year it was. What?
Well, I was paying attention to is like they sort of, you know, they had the issue of
Pesach. That's what I remember. No. There's clear labels over each food.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So we covered Shemitah. Now we go over to Yovel. The Torah says we have seven cycles of Shemitah. Okay? 7, 7, 7, 7, 7, 7, 7. After seven cycles of Shemitah, how many years is that?
49.
Oh, good. We're all mathematicians. After 49 years, the 50th year is a year of Yovel. What happens that year? So comes Rosh Hashanah, it's as though we have Shemitah a second year. This 49th year was Shemitah, the 50th year is also Shemitah, but it's a much bigger Shemitah. Because what happens in the 50th year is that on Rosh Hashanah, all the Jewish servants stop working. And they get a 10-day vacation. They spend 10 days partying on the employer's expense. He gives them to eat, he gives them to drink, and they have 10 days from Rosh Hashanah till Yom Kippur partying. On Yom Kippur, they blow the shofar. A shofar could also be called a yovel. Yovel is a ram's horn. And that's why the year is called the Yovel year, the year of the ram's horn. And that year, they blow on Yom Kippur the horn, and everyone goes free. What else happens when they blow on that horn? So all fields go back to their original owner. if you sold your field, if it goes back to you. So remember, we divided the land when we conquered it under Yoshua. Every tribe and every family knew what was their section. On Yovel, it's like hitting the reset button. So what does that mean? Torah says that means if you bought a field, let's say you bought the field 5 years before Yovel, you didn't buy the field. You bought 5 years worth of produce in that field. Because in 5 years, the field goes back to its original owner. So we have a special mitzvah in the Torah. The Torah says, don't cheat someone when you buy or sell a field for him. Because you know how many years it will take till you give it back. So your commerce, when you buy or sell a field, has to factor when Yovel is and be in accordance with that. So we have a special mitzvah that says, Al tonu, don't be unfair, don't be cheating, ish et achiv, one his brother. So this affects all our business transactions. We have a mitzvah here that when we do business, we have to be fair. Okay, you're selling a car, you know that the brakes don't work, there's an oil leak, you're going to fill the oil, and you'll park it outside where he won't see the oil leak. That's not fair. So we have a mitzvah here to be fair and honest in our business dealings. Then the Torah repeats itself. The Torah says, "Velo tonu ishet amito." You shouldn't be unfair, unkind to your friend. Why did the Torah repeat itself? So our tradition is that the Torah warned us over here, don't be unkind in the way you speak to someone. Here the Torah prohibited saying something hurtful, saying something dishonest, giving bad advice. If your intention is to hurt someone, that is prohibited. So you're not allowed to tell your wife, that cholent was terrible. Even my mother knows how to make better cholent. Even in yeshiva they serve better cholent. Ah, but you're annoyed at her? You're not allowed to say that. But the cholent really was bad. So we have an Isur Doraisa, biblical prohibition against saying something that would hurt someone else's feelings. And our sages say, Kol Hasharim Ninalim, all gates in heaven are sometimes locked, Chutz Misharei Hona'ah, except for the gates of someone who's complaining because he was hurt by others. If someone was hurt by others, then in heaven they listen to him. And we have stories in the Talmud, page after page, of people who, with pious intentions, hurt someone else, and they paid for it. There was a rabbi whose wife used to send him out to learn all year long. But on the eve of Yom Kippur, he would come home. And he'd be home with her for the holiday. And she always anticipated his arrival. One year he was in the middle of learning. He figured, I'll just finish what I'm in the middle of. But he was not going to come home on the time that his wife expected him. And so his wife was standing there after a whole year of anticipation, and she was standing by the door. The Gemara uses beautiful terminology. The Gemara says she stood there looking outside, thinking, Hashta ate, hashta ate. He's going to come now. He's going to come now. She's looking down the road. Hashtate. Notice the word almost makes you out of breath as you pronounce it. Hashtate. Hashtate. He's coming now. He's coming. And he didn't come. And it says she shed a tear in anticipation of her husband. The Gemara says he was on a balcony learning. The balcony dropped and he dropped to his death. But she was waiting for him. Right. He pained her. The balcony he was learning on dropped and he died. The Talmud says he was learning. He meant to take just a little bit longer to finish what he was doing. But after a whole year she was waiting for him, right? It says in heaven they weren't willing to forgo it. He lost his life over that. The Talmud goes page after page telling us stories of how careful we have to be not to hurt someone else with what we say.
Is it also said a lot because God knows that we're not perfect?
We're not perfect, but we have to work on it. We're moving forward to Revi. Now, the Torah says, when you sell your property, don't sell it for eternity because I own the land. The reason we make mistakes in our behavior with money is because we deceive ourselves. We think, I'm the boss, it's my money. Wrong. It's not yours. It's the Ribbono Shel Olam's. You have it. You have a responsibility with it now. It is birshutcha. It is in your reshut. It is in your permission right now, in your domain to make decisions. But it's not yours. We use the term, it's mine. Yeah, technically, legally, it's yours. But really, it's birshutcha. It is within your control. Right now, God has allowed you to control it. But it's not really yours. That's why some people, when they buy a new sefer, they write on it, L'Hashem ha'aretz umloah. Earth and everything on it belongs to Hashem. This book is currently in the possession of, and they write their name. They remind themselves, yes, it's in my possession right now, but only under the heading of L'Hashem ha'aretz umloah. Everything on earth is really Hashem's. Hashem says, when you sell property, don't sell it forever. Because Hashem gave us a mitzvah that in the Yovel year it goes back to its original owner. So Hashem says, remember, it's mine. I'm allowing you to live here. I didn't hear you.
The phrase you said?
L'Hashem ha'aretz umloah. That's a pasuk. L'Hashem ha'aretz umloah. Hashem owns the earth and everything on it. Yes, sir. Not at all. You're supposed to be very caring about your property. Righteous people care about every penny. Because when you earn every penny honestly, so then every penny matters. Caring about it does not mean that I treat it as though it's mine and therefore I won't let anyone have and I try to be as stingy as possible. Avraham Avinu was meticulously honest and tremendously wealthy and he gave free food. So Yaakov Avinu also, very honest, very careful with his money. He didn't waste, he didn't let his things get ruined. He was very careful with it. However, he was also kind with it. So this idea that Hashem owns everything, but I'm given the responsibility, I have to treat it responsibly. I shouldn't waste what I have. There's responsibility, and then there's the feeling of, I own it, I'm the boss. I'm responsible for it. Responsible means I won't waste. I have to be very careful. I shouldn't waste.
About Revi Kutera, I was once in Mashur, and they sold books sometimes, and I didn't have enough money. So I sat and I ran home to take the money. Then an old man said, no, and I will give you. I said, no, I don't. He said, no, take it. So I took the money, and the next day I brought the money back to him, and I said, to the rabbi. And he said, she should have said that. She should say that. You posted something like
a bee. Very nice. Very nice. The Torah says, if a person becomes poor, and he sells part of the land that is his family, what's called achuzah, his family land. The Torah is teaching you something. Don't sell part of your family's property. Don't sell property unless you're in dire need. Property is something you hold on to. We call property in Hebrew, nichsei delo naide. It's assets that won't go anywhere. They're not leaving you. Nichsei delo naide. That's why they call property in Hebrew nadlan. What's nadlan? It's an acronym for nichsei delo naide. It is assets that don't move. So you own land, don't sell. If a person is in dire straits, they could sell, but in general, don't sell. And even then, meyachuzato, don't sell everything, only sell part of it. The Torah teaches us that a person should always leave for himself part of the field. Leave over something that you should still own. There's a special mitzvah in the Torah that the relatives will buy it back for the family. His brother, and if not his brother, then a more distant relative, as we'll learn in Megillat Rut, there's a mitzvah to keep the property in the family. What happens if a person doesn't have a relative who can redeem it for him? So it remains in the buyer's hands until Yovel. This is in Israel, yes. Correct. After a few years, the seller makes some money. So the Torah says he can buy his property back. He has to allow the buyer to enjoy a minimum of 2 years of the property he bought. However, after that, he's allowed to buy it back, but you have to have enough money to buy it all back. Says the Torah, working with the system the Torah gave, so you know how to calculate what the value of the property is. If you know that until Yovel there were 10 years, and you sold the property for 10,000 shekel, that means each year was sold for 1,000 shekel. If 3 years passed, then you have to have 7,000 shekel to buy it back. So the Torah says, you are entitled to buy back your property before Yovel, special mitzvah in the Torah. The buyer cannot prevent you from buying it back, and you buy it at the sell price. Per what? Per the value of the years till Yovel. Yes? I didn't follow again. Right. What do you mean you bought it? If it's yours, you didn't have to buy it. The Torah said that buying property in the land of Israel does not make it yours. It's only yours till Yovel. That you got automatic from Yoshua. It stayed in the family. Every Yovel, it came back to your family. So you didn't have to buy that. That you got as an inheritance all the way back to Yoshua.
So today, we don't have this.
What can we do? Now the Torah teaches us a concept of Batei Arei Choma.
Just a question.
Yes, sir.
This idea of the land returning is only if the person sold because he needed money. If you sell it only because you want more money, it applies also?
Yeah. The Torah was just giving you advice. You shouldn't be selling for any other reason. Now the Torah tells us the exception to Yovel. You want to know which house or property that you sell does not go back in Yovel? Gabriel wants to know how can he attain property that will be his forever. So the Torah tells us a concept, right, of Batei Arei Choma. The city that is walled from the days of Yoshua bin Nun, the houses in that city, if they're sold, they're sold forever. You have 1 year to buy it back. If you didn't buy it back within that year, after that year is up, so then it's yours forever. Okay?
How about if there is a new city?
No, the walls have to date back to Yoshua bin Nun. Even if they don't have walls now. So long as in the days of Yoshua they had a wall. It has to be a city that was walled in the days of Moshe, in the days of Yoshua. It doesn't matter if today there are walls or not. That's why if you look at the text when you read it says Lo Choma, Lamed Aleph. To your eye, it says there is no wall. Our tradition is that you read it Lamed Vav, that it owns its own wall. Lamed Vav means its wall, Lo, belonging to it. Lamed Aleph means it does not have. So what you see when you look in the Torah, it says Lo, no wall. Lochoma. That's because when you look at the city today, you don't see a wall. But you hear, what you hear is Asher Lochoma. The city owned its wall. Once upon a time it had a wall. That's what you hear. They tell you in the days of Yoshua it had a wall. That's just like what you hear is not what you see in the text. So to what you hear is not what you see with regards to the city. Many cities. Exactly. Exactly. But we're only talking in Eretz Yisrael. Okay. Look in the book of Yoshua. Just on the eastern side of the Jordan, you had 60 cities with walls. Inside Israel, in the book of Yoshua, you have city after city enumerated. Geresh, Ono. You have many cities enumerated that have walls in Yoshua. Betzer. What?
Get rid of the Hashemite.
Okay. Now, the cities of the Levites, so over there, it doesn't matter if it's a walled city or not, it always goes back to the Levites. Yeah. Doesn't matter, so long as it had a wall in the days of Yoshua. So the walled cities of the Levites, those do not count as walled cities. They still go back to the Levites at Yovel. They don't have the rules of a walled city. Okay, next mitzvah in the Torah. Torah says, if a person is falling, help him out before he falls. This is a rule. I know someone whose business has been struggling for years. And once the organization said, I'm tired of helping him, I said to them, look, his expenses, legitimately, he has children with medical needs. So let's say his expenses are at 20,000 shekel a month. He's covering 16, you're covering 4. If he collapses, you'll have to cover 20. Meaning the fact that you're helping him with 4 a month seems like a big number. But remember that it's a much bigger number if all the medical needs of the family, he's doing what he can. 16 is a big number, 20 is a big number. So he's covering what he can. The fact that you're helping him, while you're helping him not collapse, that's a big thing. The Torah tells us help a person before he collapses. Because once a person falls down, sometimes you need 5 times as much to pick him back up. So the Torah gives us a mitzvah, help a person out with a loan. Very often people collapse because of lack of funds. Most businesses do not collapse because they're bad businesses. They collapse for lack of cash flow. People don't realize that perhaps the most important aspect of a business is cash flow. It's not just a question of are you succeeding. It's a question of do you have the cash flow? You owe your debtors. You have expenses. Can you cover them? You can't run your business if they're going to shut your electric on you. The fact that people owe you $500,000 doesn't help you, because right now you got to cover your costs. So the Torah tells us help a person prevent his collapse. And when you give him a loan, there is a special mitzvah not to take interest. There is a mitzvah not to pay interest. 2 mitzvot. Both people transgress if you collect interest or you pay interest. The Torah calls interest neshech. It's like the bite of a snake, because a bite of a snake initially feels minuscule, but as the venom goes up to the heart, it kills a person. So to interest, initially a person thinks it's not a big deal, but as it builds and builds, it kills a person. So people have to be careful of interest. One thing you should promise yourselves today, that you never take a loan from what they call the gray market, the loan sharks. Right now you need a loan, but then they take tremendous interest, and people spend their whole life working for them. Because right now they need money. People sometimes find themselves in the middle of a divorce, God forbid, or in the middle of all kinds of medical expenses, and they say, there's no way out, there's no way out.
Mortgage, because that's life.
Well, mortgage is a different deal. Here in Israel, it's a mitzvah to buy a house. A mortgage is a very cheap form of interest long term. It's a very cheap way of getting money. The mortgages in Israel are built on a heter iska, where the way the deal is set up is that they're buying a portion of your house, and they get, it's a, we set it up like this. Let's say I want to build a business. I tell you, I need a loan of $1 million. I'm going to buy this business, and I believe this business will make me a profit of $30,000 a month. I need $1 million from you. I will make over $250,000 a year. You tell me, look, I'll lend you $1 million. No problem. I don't want interest from you. However, I want you to guarantee me that you will give me $5,000 a month of your profits. Whether you make it or not, you're giving me $5,000 a month. That's what you're guaranteeing me that this business will produce. If you make four or five or seven, that's the guarantee. So then, you're not collecting interest. You're buying a percentage of the profit in my business. Right? That's called the heter isca. We have more complicated forms of this, but generally that's how the banks are set up today. That's why it's permissible, and it's a mitzvah to buy a house in Israel, so we rely on that, and we take a mortgage in order to buy a house, etc., in Israel.
It would be like something like, instead of the simply giving you the money and then getting more, the bank is kind of being your partner?
Correct, exactly. Yes, sir.
Suppose buying land of Israel is a mitzvah. And what about, I was confused. When in today's generation there are many buildings, many floors. Is there many floors?
Still a mitzvah.
Buying the floor is...
Still a mitzvah, yeah. Buying a house in Israel, yes. It's part of you living here, yes. Yes.
Why it says that you should not lend to your with interest to your brother, is specifying the Jewish part?
Correct. Because this is part of being the club of the Jewish people. We don't lend to our brothers with interest. We don't borrow from them with interest. However, just like I'm not allowed to pay a Jew interest, I'm not allowed to collect from him interest. But a non-Jew, I'm allowed to pay interest to. It goes both ways. I'm allowed to pay, I'm allowed to collect. It goes both ways. It's a special benefit of being part of the club. Meaning normal business, money's worth money. Yeah.
What's the story with banks, though? Banks need shareholders are Jewish and not Jewish, so how do you follow that?
So we said banks generally do. Heter iska. That's what we...
I mean, not in Israel. How's that work?
It's a long discussion. Thursday night.
Well, I gotta go up the club. Yeah, I'll be at Meron. I'm going to be here.
So next week there's...
Okay.
What about overcharging? Let's say rent of an office should be, let's say, 1,000 shekels a month, but some of Jews, let's say, in Israel, Jewish businesses, you know, there's a few offices for rent. Why is charging 1,000? The market rate for 10 square meters is 1,000 shekels a month, let's just say. And the other places charge 2,500. They know they're overcharging. Is that like a bad thing for Jews to do that to other Jews?
So when the Torah said "Lo tonu," don't be unfair in your business practices, what the Torah is saying is if there is a going rate, and in real estate usually there isn't a going rate, usually the fluctuations of the market are so high that it's hard to say there's one rate. You can buy a deal. I was told that in one building, the same apartment, one seller was selling for $500,000 and the other one was selling for $750,000. It blew my mind. That's a difference of 50%. He was 250,000 shekel higher than the other one, and his apartment was like two floors up without an elevator. How'd that happen? So in real estate, it's difficult to say that there's really a going rate. People get away with a lot of things. Sometimes there's someone who wants an apartment in this building, etc. I know someone who couldn't find tenants for his apartment. Couldn't find tenants. He advertised everywhere. He went down in price from 2,000 to 1,800 to 1,500 to 1,200. He went down to 1,200 shekel. He said, I just got to find the tent. No one was interested. Finally, he got fed up. Someone called him up and said, my mother wants to move into this building. I live one flight down. Would you rent it for her for 1,900? He said, sold. Okay, but he had gone from 2 to 1,200. He had gone down almost 50% from his price. Is there I'm saying, so there's a, it's hard to say in real estate that there's a market value. That's the concept that the Gemara says, Eino na bekarka. When it comes to real estate, this guy wants to build a building next door, so this house is worth more to him. Real estate, the market value fluctuates depending on many factors. And so in real estate, it's harder to say that. However, if you're selling a bag of milk, and everyone knows that there's a price for a bag of milk in Israel, but your buyer doesn't know, right? The guy who takes a taxi from the airport, and the taxi should cost him 120 shekel, and the driver tells him 120, and he pulls out 120 euros, and the driver says, no tip. So the driver ripped him off, right? It was supposed to be 120 shekel. There's a going rate for that. There's a fare for that distance. That's called onah. He cheated the guy where there's a going rate. Yes?
What was the problem? If he's asking 1,100, he's making 1,900, is he cheating the customer? Is it really
no,
price?
Because the real price is, that's the price, 1,900. He was prepared to go down.
You know, he advertised the other rates though.
It depends on what he did. You're right. There can be instances.
Like that's why.
There can be instances where you're right.
Okay.
You're right. There can be instances that way. The Torah says, what happened if your brother really lost all assets and finally he sells himself as a servant? So the Torah says, treat him as hired help. Treat him as an employee. Don't treat him as a slave. And take care of him. Take care of his family. Take care of his children. And treat him respectfully. Because they're all mine, says their bon shalom. Don't make him work parech. What is parech? That is work that will break him. That is work that's meant to afflict him. That is pointless labor. That is endless labor. You cannot make him work in a way, the way the Egyptians made the Jews work, what's called avodat parech. The Torah says, you want to buy servants? You need workers? So you can buy from the nations all around you that are selling slaves historically. Nations, the slaves would beg for a Jew to buy them. Because the Jews have mitzvos in the Torah how to treat a slave well. If a slave was working for someone else, he could get beaten and he could get very bad treatment. In the Torah, a slave has rights, a slave has mitzvos, a slave has a year to decide if he wants to convert to Judaism or not. A non-Jew who is bought as a slave is told, if you want to stay in our employment, you have to decide within a year, do you want to accept the mitzvos of the Jewish people? If the slave wants to, so within that year, we bring him to a court, they circumcise him, he goes to mikvah, and he becomes an eved kenani. And he is obligated to do mitzvos like a woman. He has half the mitzvos, he's like half a Jew. He's not a complete Jew, he has half the mitzvos. He remains in the Jewish ownership, but he has a lot of benefits. The Jewish nation. Yeah. The Torah says, what happens if a non-Jew buys a Jew? There are non-Jews in Israel. You know, there are very, very wealthy Palestinians in Israel. Mamasha, very, very wealthy. So imagine that one of them buys a Jew as his slave. So the Torah gives us a special mitzvah. His relatives have to buy him back. His uncle, his cousin, his relatives have a mitzvah. They should buy him back. Why? Because he won't be able to keep Shabbos. He won't be able to keep kosher. He won't be able to keep the mitzvahs. You have to buy him back. What happens if you don't buy him back? By Yovel, he goes free. If the non-Jew buys a Jewish slave in Israel, so he's also bound by the laws of the land. Yovel, he goes free. And when you buy him back, you have to be fair with him. You have to calculate how many years are left that he was supposed to work for him and pay him. What happens if your relative is a problematic person? He wants to gamble, he wants to drink. So every time he runs out of money, he goes to his non-Jewish neighbor and he says, buy me. So this neighbor buys him. And then his relatives have to come and bail him out. So one opinion in Talmud says, you bail him out and he becomes your servant. So your brother or your cousin is your servant. He can't go and sell himself again. Meaning if you see he's a problematic person, so you tell him, I bought you, now you work in my house. You're not free to go back and gamble and sell yourself again. Now you're my worker until Yovel. Okay, so we still have a few concepts to discuss in our parsha. We will meet again, Be'ezrat Hashem, Thursday night.